You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Welcome out there in Rock Art Podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, for episode 156, if you can imagine that. And we are blessed and honored to have a gentleman by the name of Dr. James Dodd. He's a researcher at the Aarhus University and a board member of the Scandinavian Society for Prehistoric Art. And understand James specializes in digital documentation and analysis of that Scandinavian rock art. James, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you.
Well, it's a blessing and an honor to have you. I don't think we've had anyone in the 6 years that we've been running this from your part of the universe, part of the world. Scandinavia is a whole different piece of terrain, isn't it? Quite different in some ways.
Well, I mean, it depends what you're comparing it to. If you're comparing it to the desert, certainly.
Rains
all the time, and I don't know, about now, I think it's about -2 outside.
Oh, my word. You're kidding me. Oh, my word. Woo! Wow. That's wild.
And that's not even cold.
And that's not even cold, right?
Oh, no, not at all. But yeah, but I'll be glad of my winter tires when I'm out on the road going to work.
I bet. So, Dr. James Dodd, I always ask this as an opening question. How did you ever get involved in the study, analysis, research on rock art?
Well, it all started really when I was about age 3, because my parents took me on a holiday to Scandinavia, Norway, Sweden, and a little bit of Denmark. And I was and I've always been interested in art, and I was fascinated at this early age already by the idea of these paintings drawn on the rock. You know, it was sort of nature was on some giant canvas. Of course, at the time, I didn't know that the rock carvings in Scandinavia were painted for the tourists, but still, it made quite an impression. And particularly when you think this picture of me, age 3, at the rock carving site, that my mother took, and I'm almost as high as some of the figures that age. So that's how it sort of started, as a toddler.
Yes.
And then life took me in sort of various directions. In particular, I became much more interested in history. History is still something I have an interest in. And you could say that also shaped the later direction of my PhD. But then eventually I became somewhat dissatisfied with the study of history, reasons we can go into if you want. And then I chose archaeology, mainly because it was based on fact and evidence. It wasn't just, what one or more or just what was written. And of course, as we all know from the study of history, historiography, the power of the written, history becomes depends on who writes it, so to say. As Hermann Goering famously said at Nuremberg, history is written by the victors.
Right.
And that's one thing in itself, but in terms of what we're, if we're interested in what actually happened, then at least you have the hard evidence in the archaeology. And that became quite attractive to me. So that led me to archaeology. And then from that, of course, at some point you have to choose a speciality. And then it came back to those rock carvings in Scandinavia. I still had this interest. Really, the ball started rolling from there, really. So a master's dissertation, a bachelor's dissertation, and then a master's dissertation at Durham University written on aspects of Scandinavian rock art, mainly Norwegian rock art.
What specifically was your PhD dissertation on with respect to Norwegian and Scandinavian rock art?
Well, if we allow the explanation to continue, then of course, if you're studying Scandinavian rock art, the next career move, so to say, was you have to go to Scandinavia. So then I started. well, just the same. You might say studying Australian rock art, rock art of the US,
right,
etc. Yeah, it's also the library provision as well. Okay. You're not able to get everything on a lot of rare and out-of-print books on interlibrary loans. So then Brexit happened, and then it was now or never, so to say. And then I was lucky enough to get the PhD scholarship at Aarhus University. So, yeah, the title of the PhD, yeah, originally it was meant to be a study of regional differences in Scandinavian rock art, and with a big sort of focus on the rock art of Bornholm, which was an area I'd started to work with quite extensively since 2013 in collaboration with Bornholm's Museum. But then again, here we go. We had a thing called Corona, and things didn't quite turn out the way myself and others expected. And the interest in history really raised its head again.
Okay.
So that led to the topic of my PhD, and that was in... Well, the dissertation is entitled Sign Structure and Cryptanalysis.
Huh.
And yeah, so here we go. So, and how we could use methodology from cryptanalysis to derive, based on the outcomes, the figures, unknowns in this about the figures, in this case, in general speaking terms, the underlying significance of the figures, if to put it in the most neutral terms possible. So it's not to say, can we read rock art? You can't read it in the same sense as you might want to decrypt this particular communication or an email, but perhaps we can get information about the context and the subjects. And this is all very well established principles within the field of military signals intelligence. And then we go into all sorts of very detailed things about also certain people who've had certain connections between rock art, study of early computer archaeology, and cryptanalysis.
This is something I know virtually nothing about. I haven't run across cryptanalysis in my journey or adventure in rock art. So can you give us a thumbnail of what that is?
Yeah. Well, essentially, you're trying to do two things. But you're both trying to, as cryptanalysts and rock art researchers, interested about the underlying significance of the images, so the subjects referred to and the like, are interested in the same thing. The tasks are quite similar. You have to derive information about events based only on observation of the outcomes. And these outcomes are comprised of incomplete, partial, and fragmentary information. So, and in both cases, from a pure communication perspective, you have the basis of a sender-message-receiver data model.
Okay.
It's proposed by Claude Shannon. It's a very basic model in terms of communication theory, but it has been applied to rock art. And that was sort of how the genesis of all this started by Professor Emeritus Jarl Nordblatt, university whose supervisor worked for the Forsvarets Radioanstalt, the Swedish Signals Intelligence Agency, during the Second World War, cryptanalyzing German communications.
When you've done this cryptoanalysis and somehow teased out certain contextual elements, what do we know? What do we learn? What insights or particular fragments of information do we get?
Ooh, well, we could be here for hours, but we have to keep it brief, of course.
Please.
Yes, and cogent. So... Yeah, I mean, what I've sort of come with is a methodology.
Okay.
How you can take the various stages of cryptanalysis and then apply them in a workflow to rock art. And we can talk about that a bit more if you want. But yeah, what do you get out of it? As I said, you don't get, you know, here was James and John. I mean, you might in certain situations, if you particularly have living informants who can supply information. So if you know, let's just say we were in Australia and you had Aboriginal informants and they perhaps said, okay, it's this story, which is depicted in this scene, blah, blah, blah. Okay, and it's in this and this scene. Then you could go hunting through the images to find the same sequence in other places.
Okay.
For example. So it's things like the syntax, deriving the typographic code. There are various types of graphic code in use by non-literate societies, and this is becoming increasingly understood and the subject of quite a lot of research and some very interesting projects. The structure of the code has different codes have different kind of structures, and these can be differentiated. Essentially, this boils down to a very important, very difficult, but also very difficult mathematical problem, that of within the field of graph theory, and in particular, the graph isomorphism problem, which is one of the great unsolved problems and most important problems in computer science, but also in the natural sciences as well, and has a variety of applications way beyond rock art or military applications. Yeah, so that asks, are two networks the same? Now, quite quickly, answering that question becomes very mathematically complex. So its exact problem complexity is not impossible, what's known as MP complete or MP hard, but it is somewhere in between that and MP. So that is what I mean by this MP, MP complete. We'll skip the definitions, but one is basically, if you've got enough computing power, you can solve it. The other is, you can't, even if you have all the computing power in the world, you'll be at the problem endlessly until the end of time. It's somewhere in between. So if you can find some way of reducing the number of possibilities, then it just becomes a question of your computing power. And there are various algorithms developed to certain applications. And so to say, that's really what I'm seeking money for a postdoc for at the moment.
Are you?
So.
Well, let's stop there. I think it's a good stopping place. Mm-hmm. And for my listeners, we'll see you on the flip-flop, gang. Well, welcome back, everybody. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel talking to Dr. James Dodd. And we're talking about some rather sophisticated technical elements of the way he has found significantly to learn something about the past and about the nature of rock art. So I asked him, of course, the million-dollar question, what does all of this matter? And what's the takeaway? What is something that we're learning from these activities that we were engaged in terms of the analysis of rock art? And I'll let you take it, James.
I think it's a really good question. And there are lots of takeaways, but I think one of the big takeaways, actually, I think is quite, which could be grasped, you know, by many in different areas and different fields, is that the notion that what is represented in rock art is, so to say, random, and that there is no relation whatsoever between rock art and language does seem to become rather untenable the closer you inspect it. So you could say, okay, have you conducted a statistical analysis? No, but it could be done. But by very virtue of the fact that certain things are represented in a given rock art tradition, in this case, the southern tradition, you know, the Bronze and Iron Age rock carvings of particular parts of Scandinavia, at the exclusion of others, tells you, okay, there is a selection. And of course, the moment you start introducing selection, you have to ask yourself, why? Okay, once you, of course, you've accepted the premise that something is not there, you know, absence of evidence is also evidence, then, of course, you start to think, well, why choose these particular figures? And therefore, then the corollary is, okay, this probably must have some sort of explanation that if we could have a time machine, we could ask prehistoric informants, what does this mean? And they could give us some sort of podcast on what this all means, some verbal explanation. And that link between the image and the spoken word means that for various reasons that cryptanalysts know very well, that structures from language are somehow carried through. That's not like the structure of speech, but should we say pattern behavior? So patterns and repetitions. And of course, patterns and repetitions, that's how they work in their field. But that's also how we work in archaeology. You know, we have our finds and we try and extrapolate various trends and, you know, based on the evidence. And then we spend endless hours discussing what we think of these finds. If you like, that's what we do in our field.
So a couple of ideas or reflections come to me when we're talking about this. I've had 6 years to talk to people all over the world about how they're doing rock art. And one of the things that is sort of bubbling up is that they're trying to connect with descendants, with affiliated people or populations, individuals that might have something to say, some insight, some wisdom about the nature of these images. That's one thing. The other thing that's, I'll go the other direction, that's troubling to me, at least in the States here, is that I think the United States is fairly far behind the rest of the world in terms of the sophistication or the significance, the meaning or the recognition of a discipline of rock art. And the reason I say that is some of the top people who I've connected with, in California, but also in other areas of the country and around the world, have had occasion to say, well, Alan, it's only rock art. You can say whatever you want to say about this because there's no way of knowing. What are your thoughts on those particular issues?
Yeah, well, of course, we must be, must always be polite to our American colleagues. But well, in the sense it's that, for example, and respect for their work. But so, for example, I've had a big turning point in terms of the rock art and language question was the work of Dr. Kaiser of the rock art of the Central Plains.
Yeah,
and there you have the biographic, the ceremonial tradition. Yeah, you have two traditions concurrently. This is earth shattering to Scandinavian archaeologists because. You know, they love to say, oh, it's all about this or all about that. How many times have we read this?
Sure.
But actually, the fact that we can have two traditions is okay. This could explain actually how, in some ways, both camps can be right, in inverted commas, or is evidence support their case. So that's why I say, actually, you might say that in some ways, the study of rock art in the States lags behind. But I think there are some, particularly in... Of course, valid contributions being made, of course.
Of course.
And these should not be downplayed. But I think really you come to the nub of the point in that whoever this anonymous person you obviously quoted there, it's only rock art. So it's seen as a sort of, and not just in America, but I think historically also in Scandinavia, it was, if we look in the 1800s, 1900s, it was sort of seen... Well, it's something else. I think a German professor said, rock art, it doesn't count. You can't use that to anything.
Right. It was a difficult data set to incorporate into archaeology. You can't pick it up and take it back and put a number on it. You have a difficulty dating it sometimes, often. And it seems somewhat mysterious sometimes because of the nature of the imagery, which may not be transparent.
Yeah, but if I may continue,
please.
Yeah, I think really to pursue that line, I mean, that's how I think it has been maybe seen, the inability to deal with it, at least at the start, was seen as okay, it's a little problem, so I'll put it in a box and hope it'll go away. Rock art is unique as a source of information in that it relates to information on the semantic level. Again, here we go back to this. Link between something somebody can explain in words, even if it really is, we went out and we killed some prey or killed a bison or whatever. It's not remains of life. Say pottery, post holes.
It's not that.
Exactly. So
it's
actually,
it's a different kind of an artifact.
Yeah, special kind of information.
Special kind of information.
And that's of course why so much rock art is on the World Heritage List. I think it is considered irreplaceable because that insight is unique. But again, I don't know where one would say, I'm not fully qualified necessarily to judge the state of rock art research in the US, but where it is, so to say, in relation to these debates, because I think there's a lot of great good work being done out there, of course.
Of course.
Yeah.
And we certainly... We're stymied for a time when we were hyper-focused on the function, origin, and relationship of shamanism to rock art. But I think we've gone past that. I don't know. What's your thought on that one?
Yeah, I would say yes. I think at least informed readers, shall we say, or informed scholars, you're reading widely enough, the internet is a wonderful thing, you encounter other viewpoints and perspectives. And that's also important to emphasize with the language issue. It's, rock art language doesn't mean it's all about that. This is just one aspect of it.
Thank you.
Because it can also, shall we say, fill the picture too much as well. But I think it's interesting also how these, shall we say, trends.
They're trends, absolutely.
Yeah, sort of come and go. I was about to say paradigm, but... Yeah, maybe that can be too strong a word, but perhaps in some disciplines and areas, certain things like, yeah, is it shamanism? Is it totemism? One versus the other? Yeah, it can just come fill the whole thing. Yeah, fill the whole picture. Languages as well, also historically. So I think it's interesting, for example, in Scandinavia, some of the earliest studies were actually, well, is it a form of prehistoric writing? Called Brunius in Tarnum, he wrote to Jean-François Champollion, you know, the decipher who deciphered hieroglyphs for the first time. Yeah. And you could say in some ways, are we sort of going a bit, things have gone around a bit full circle with my work, in that one revisits the idea, okay, is there some relation to language? Okay, it's not a script. Yeah, and once you move away from that, then you start to open up all sorts of different possibilities. But previously, the idea, rock art is not writing. Oh, end of story, move on. Let's talk about shamanism. Let's talk about totemism. Let's talk about landscape location.
Have you found in your studies that some of the imagery relates to sacred narratives, oral traditions?
Yes, exactly. The answer is yes. I mean, in Scandinavia, during the North European Bronze Age, there is a large body of consensus. You know, we all agree on that mostly, that there is some relationship between myths, beliefs, cosmology, and that of some sort of narrative relating to the journey, the eternal journey of the sun, as proposed by Fleming Cowell. And various actors involved. And these are also depicted, for example, also in bronze, sometimes plastic, most famously, the chariot of the sun in the National Museum of Denmark, a horse pulling a disc, gold, gilded with gold on one side and plain on the other, but both sides with decoration, which differs between the sides. So really what I focused in was this narrative. And it's important to emphasize also, again, with these doubters, it's just one of many narratives. And many people overlook that quite important sentence in Cowell's work, 1998, Ships on Bronzes. Mm-hmm. But it is there. It's just one that's rather easy to trace. And that is the same reason I went for it. So in the rock art of Bornholm, I'd done various digital documentation, and of course, looked at the existing documentation and studied it. And in a nutshell, there is some evidence for recurring sequences of figures. In fact, one example of a repeat of 3 to 4 figures, which is identical. And these repeats overlap. So you imagine a sort of daisy series of chains, of sequences of images, and by working in the old, by sort of, if you imagine these as sort of, that's what I did. I wrote them all out on bits of paper, and then you sort of shuffle them around and you find the overlap. And that's exactly how they work in Bletchley Park as well, to find, with these settings of the Enigma rotors.
I understand. Oh, I like it. I like our conversation. Yeah. Let's stop there, the second segment, and we'll go to the third and see you on the flip-flop, gang. Okay, boys and girls, this is Dr. Alan Garfinkel, your host for episode 156 with Dr. Dodd. We're talking about some of the technical elements of Scandinavian rock art and his insights and wisdom from a lifetime, obviously, of very sophisticated analysis and impressive documentation of the rock art of that part of the world. Dr. James, it's all yours. What do you think is the takeaway?
Well, if we were to try and take some takeaway from this conversation, on which we've had just a chance to really scratch the surface, I think I would probably say, in sum, to think about the role of orality in non-literate societies and how that relates to the preservation of knowledge and communication of information in said societies, and from there to reconsider the relationship between rock art and language.
When you say orality, are you talking about oral traditions?
So your orality is the use of the spoken word to memorize with certain aids,
right,
information. And of course, this is very often very important in societies to preserve information about their history.
Preliterate societies. Absolutely.
Yes. And they do this using aids, in this case, the images as a mnemonic.
images are a mnemonic, a means of teaching, a means of learning, a means of communicating. It's a prompt. Okay. Yes.
You know, like you have your lecture and you have your index card and you suddenly go blank. You look down and, oh, yes, you know, have a word or something. And then that prompts you to that, whatever it is you plan to talk about. Of course, they don't have the scripts that we have, that we use and sort of think about, but they used images instead. And this is, there are many ethnographic precedents for this. And I think looking in those traditions, I think, where you have the testimony, if that is possible, because yes, you've got to show respect for our indigenous communities. I think if you looked at those structures, and again, we go back to, if we look in different societies, they use images in different ways, and not just rock art, it's also in other media. You could then start to, once you can maybe define a sort of structure or certain characteristics of, which can be described formally, of a graphic code, to then try and differentiate between different graphic codes in the past. And then once you do that, then when it comes to the specific type of graphic code known as a speech-bound notation, so that's basically where there's a syntax, you can have long information strings, then you can really start to, I wouldn't say you can't read rock art. Again, you can never do that. And that's an important takeaway. It's not writing. But then I think we're going to come to a lot of more informed conclusions about the past.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, I believe that rock art is one of the most valuable data sets that any archaeologist can have. I don't see it as impossible to understand. I don't see it as, I think sometimes it's so transparent that it communicates to you, rather in a facile way. At least that's what I've found on occasion. Does that agree with your perspective or no?
So if I understand by that, you mean that sort of the response it generates in you transcends the boundaries of time? Is that understood?
Yeah, I would say that, yeah. Or the images that are being used are, once you really understand or have steeped yourself in the ethnographic record and looked at, cross-culturally for me, forager cosmology all over the world, that some of this stuff is rather, evident in terms of what the communication was.
Well, it's an interesting thought. I mean, there are also two or three points which come to mind. I mean,
please do.
First is that, so to say, what I would call the other camp, some people, particularly looking at, in the materialistic ontological turn, they sort of have the premise that our responses in, basically it's to do with how we're biologically wired. So our responses in the present are the same as those in the past because you evolved.
It's our software. It's the human
story. Yeah, if you want to call it that. And by studying ourselves, we can study the past. Yeah. Valid, possible, yeah. But again, we must also bear in mind, you take the software analogy, you can have different software, but you can create different products for that software.
Absolutely. And they can be very different.
Yeah, and then I would go to what I was going to say, quote L.P. Hartley, and the past is a different country.
The past is a different
country. They do things differently
country.
There.
Yes.
Yeah, from the novel The Go-Between. And that's, I think, also why I issue a note of caution, because again, we look at the past is shaped by our present, and then we then project that into our into our present and et cetera, et cetera. So, I think it has to be a bit careful. It's not to say can't use it, but be careful and remember that things are different. Yeah, well, kind of being very different to the way we think
just
now.
Drastically and dramatically different.
Yeah.
And we're, even though we're both of the human kind, often our lives are so drastically different, it's almost impossible for us to even perceive or somehow, intuit the meaning of some of this. And so, yes, I'd agree in much of what we see. I don't know if it's difficult or impossible, but it certainly is rather challenging to sort of tease out what they're saying, what the communication is, and what the inference is. Although that being said as well, I find that even across literally thousands and thousands of years, there are symbols and expressions that seem to transcend time.
Well, and, yeah, the cut mark is the example. Yeah, and you're right. It is curious that it occurs in so many different places, and even some of the cross-cultural symbolism. I recommend an article I wrote with Gerhard Milstreu on this subject, and that was inspired, in fact, by a lecture he gave, and I basically sort of talked him into, yeah, you got to write, this is brilliant, because he just took this helicopter perspective and really pointed out what you're saying, the similarities, and they are remarkable. I mean, why is that? I mean, again, big question. Could be, you could say biological, but also, then if we look at the language angle, so to say, something comes to mind that somebody said, when the more languages that you know, well, yeah, the more you look at the languages of the world, you actually realize how similar they are than how different they are.
Sure.
And that sounds quite strange when you read it at first, but I mean,
it's true.
I can't remember how many languages, five languages I speak now. But it's French, a bit of German, English, of course, Norwegian, Danish. Yeah, so we're up to five.
But that does give you a very unique understanding or perspective on rock art.
Yeah, because basically when you learn a new language, you often find, so it's a bit the same as in French. Okay, so you have the agreement, you have the genders, you know, okay, yeah, but there's no endings in this one. Oh, thank God, you know, no irregular German vocabulary. You know, but you see, you end up tacking things on and borrowing. I mean, that's a nightmare when you try to go back to the other language because the mapping, and that's a technical term, in your brain, your wires have got crossed. And so sometimes you start speaking French and Danish and then the other way around. It's maddening. But that's actually why you realize, okay, well, you know, where's the verb here? Where's the... Okay, in Danish, adjectives are unique. That's how Google Translate more or less differentiates.
Given your life has been around rock art for quite a while, decades, right?
Yep.
What would you tell the general public or even a dilettante scholar about rock art that they should take home and reflect on?
I think I would go back to the idea of being an absolutely unique source of information, which tells you not how they live, but what they thought.
What they thought.
Yeah.
Not how they lived, but how they thought.
And because it has this relationship on the semantic level. So it's telling you about, again, these thoughts can be, you know, very everyday, so to say. Mm. You know, and when I say everyday, I think, you know, for example, look at the work by Peter Skoglund, Joachim Goldhammer with the Imuran, this living rock art tradition that they've studied. Yeah, it's sort of say on quite sort of short and sweet in terms of the amount of information conveyed. But okay, there's still, it relates to hunting events or whatever, that they've experienced during that day. It's just one part. But then, of course, at the other end, it's very complex.
Yeah, but it's a permanent record. That's not permanent.
But
it's a physical mnemonic record of ancestral thoughts and stories and experiences and the yearnings and the visions and the wants and needs of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
they're on the stone. And
it has a certain permanence as a media.
Yeah, that in itself is amazing.
Yeah, and of course, you know, there's a reason we carve things in stone ourselves. It's, you know, it's so, well, here we go. We just had, we will remember them.
Yeah, we will remember them.
You know, you see in the Psalm, you see the cenotaph, you know. Yeah, it is carved in stone. Yeah, I never thought of it like that. But, you know, just those words to us probably conjure, well, again, maybe it's cultural. Yeah, it conjures a certain image or certain images to mind, and a certain architecture and a certain, you know, the color of the stone and the Flanders fields, etc. So I think maybe in the past, you know, it was also something there. But of course, you know, there's stone, but there's also other media. You know, I think we, of course, lack the information on the perishable media by and large. So that's a whole part of the puzzle which is missing. And of course, you're using different sort of, using in a different way, or even not at all. You know, is it is carving in stone something reserved only for certain things? I mean, again, that's where I say about, you know, we have a carved headstone, you know, or something like that, or, yeah, on our grave, you know, so we're remembered. So there is something deep there, I think, maybe connected to remembrance.
So I'm a Catholic, and in church they give homilies, and I've stolen a couple of words that they've used in the past that I think fit rock art. One is memory palace, and the other one is personal immortality.
Yes.
I think they fit in some ways.
Well, again, if you think, you know, in Australia, you know, that they can go there, and that is their ancestor, and, you know, or their ancestor.
Yeah.
So many generations removed, and that is the personal memory. And of course, again, we go back to, I mean, really, identity. I mean, my former supervisor at Dharmio, Margarita, professor now, Margarita Díaz Andreu, now at Barcelona, you know, the sense of her identity, and of course, in the present, you know, nationalism, you know, her speciality, you know, one of her specialities, is, you know, who we are defines our existence in the present. And of course, we see it all around us. I mean, again, I draw the Putin analogy.
Okay.
You know, in the interview, the only interview he gave to the West, you know, he talked for, what was it, a great length about history and about where he saw they had come from. We can also look again in National Socialist Germany and also other, you know, all around the world. You know, many of these societies, they use the past to define who they are in the present.
Exactly.
And it's related to the personal remembrance and how people are remembered.
Yes. I think we're going to have to stop there. God bless you. I think you had it. This was a fantastically interesting conversation. And thank you, Dr. Dodd, for your wondrous associations and reflections on this hour.
And thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And see you on the flip-flop, gang.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultura Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.